92.3 and AM 1620. Welcome to Let's Go Pensacola. I am your host, Julio Diaz. Hope you are having a great day, whether you're listening to us live on Saturday afternoon here on News Radio, or if you're listening to us on the podcast, whenever you choose to listen to the podcast. Hope you're having a great day and hope we can make it even better for you by bringing you up to date on everything that's going on in entertainment and pop culture. And if you didn't know about the fact that you can hear this show as a podcast, yes, you can. Anywhere you get your podcast, search for Let's Go Pensacola, and you can hear this whole show in its entirety. And, you know, you never know. Maybe you'll find something a little extra sometimes. Every once in a while, we run a little long and we let it run on the podcast. Doesn't happen that often, but it happens. So, you know, check us out. Or, you know, you can find it through the News Radio website as well. Anyway, joining me to talk about everything that's going on in entertainment and pop culture, as he does so very often, please welcome from the Pop Culture Nihilist channel on YouTube, Jeremy Branch.
I like that. It doesn't happen very often. It happens every other segment when you and I record the show, and I love it. We're always like, oh, dang, we went over 40 seconds. So, yeah, add us to your RSS feed. Make sure to check out Let's Go Pensacola everywhere your podcasts are available. I don't know. It's pretty early in the show, but I don't think it's ever too early for an R. Kelly reference.
Too early for an R. Kelly reference, but go ahead.
I am currently trapped in the closet. We got Blue Angels flying overhead. I'm trying to keep the audio fidelity at least reasonable. So if you do hear jets flying overhead, it's the Blue Angels. Support your local Blue Angels.
It's just the sound of freedom, folks.
That's exactly right, Julio. Yeah. I'm glad you said that.
Yeah, it's the sound of America. I wanted to start out by issuing just like a quick update on what we wound up talking about last week, which was the whole deleted scene that was released from Deadpool and Wolverine and the speculation on whether Gambit was still alive at the end of the movie. We'll put up the spoilers again here. It's been out for 2 months now, folks. If you haven't seen Deadpool and Wolverine yet, it's on you at this point. But the whole question of whether Gambit is alive and whether anybody else survived. And I actually saw the movie again last weekend. And I can tell you in so many words now that, yes, everybody that was from like the Forgotten Hero Squad at the end of the movie is definitely still alive, because Wade, in so many words, asks the TVA to save the people that helped them. And the TVA agrees to do it. And I know after that, the only one we actually see on screen is X-23. But the implication is they saved not only X-23, but also Gambit and Blade and Elektra.
See, that's interesting. I actually knew that last week. I just wanted you to discover it on your own.
Okay,
and
sure
in no
did.
Way did was that an oversight on my part.
Absolutely, Jeremy. I believe you just as much as I believe that... I can't say what I don't believe, because that'll end up getting us into politics and that won't be good. So we'll avoid that subject entirely. But you had something you were hyped about when you came onto the call today, Jeremy. Why don't you hit me with that?
We got a fun show planned for today. We're just going to take a lot of the things that are circulating and percolating on the internet and kind of do a little bit of commentary on them. And among those things is the fact that Blumhouse is releasing The Wolfman. It stars a guy that I don't know his name. He was in a movie called Possessor, which was directed by David Cronenberg's son, Brandon. It's a really good movie. He was in one with Margaret Qualley called Sanctuary. Equally good movie.
I'm sorry, I'm just always sold on Margaret Qualley, but yeah, that's okay. Go ahead.
You got to check this movie out. So Blumhouse, kind of patchy track record. I think we can agree on that. They've done some really good ones. And at first, they were kind of a mark of quality, but they just started putting their name on so many different projects and just kind of cranking out mediocre horror movies that the reputation has waned a little bit. However, I think that Lee Whannell is very talented. All the way back when he was writing for the Saw franchise, he's went on to direct really good films, including the recent Blumhouse update to The Invisible Man, which starred Kate...
Elizabeth Moss.
Yeah.
Not Kate Moss.
So there's a new movie coming out. A trailer was released, but even backing up a little bit before that, I saw a lot of conjecture because there was an image of the Wolfman, and people are reacting very strongly to it, Julio. I actually sent you a picture of it. It is an image of the Wolfman.
Let's back up here. We're not even sure that it's an image of the Wolfman.
So we have
we believe that it's a character that's going to appear in the Wolfman, but it may not necessarily be the Wolfman himself.
We believe that this is the actual Wolfman that's going to be featured in the movie.
No, the internet believes that. The internet believes that. I'm not saying I believe that.
No, I'm with you. But so the trailer was released. You and I both got a second to check it out. Do you have any faith in this movie?
I mean, the trailer's interesting, and, you know, like you said, the Lee Whannell Invisible Man movie was very well received. I'm always here for a take on the classic Universal Monsters. I'd really like to see the classic Universal Monsters come back. I want it to be well done. But the teaser was cool.
Can I ask you this? We're taking American Werewolf in London off the table. Can you name three good werewolf movies?
The Howling.
Love it. The Howling 2, your sister's a werewolf.
You said we're taking American Werewolf in London off the table, huh?
So of course
the original Lon Chaney Wolfman. You got to give me that.
Yeah, absolutely.
And actually the remake isn't bad either. The Joe Johnston remake from 2010, was it? I think.
I thought that was not bad either. Ginger Snaps?
You know, I haven't seen Ginger Snaps. I keep meaning to get around to that. I have heard good things about it. This is a conversation we need to bring our buddy Nick Flagstar in on, because he's the werewolf aficionado.
Absolutely. I'm excited to check it out. Y'all let us know if you're eager to see the Blumhouse version of the Wolfman as well.
Yeah, but so the image that we're talking about, though, it doesn't even actually come from the movie. It comes from Halloween Horror Nights.
And so, people are roasting the movie for it.
And we don't even know that this is related to the movie. Because Universal does 10 different haunted houses at Halloween Horror Nights. This could be an image from any of the haunted houses. People have just taken it upon themselves to declare it that this is the Wolfman. This is what he's going to look like. There's not a haunted house this year that's themed on the Wolfman movie that's coming out next year.
Yeah.
They usually don't do one based on a movie that's not out yet. Now, they did make an exception last year because they had that Exorcist Believer haunted house like a month before the movie came out. But the movie was coming out while Halloween Horror Nights was still going on. This movie's not coming out till next year.
To my understanding, it's not that it's a haunt attraction or one of the themed places, but rather like a little promotional booth as you're kind of walking through the thing. However, it could be that just some random scare actor or even an attendee was in that costume and just happened to stand in front of the booth for a moment. We have no idea, but I just think it's hilarious how up in arms everybody is already about it.
I mean, you know, that's what the internet's for, I guess.
Yeah, it is.
You know, it's goes back to that thing. What's the line from Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back? The internet is a place where people can gather together and trade pornography and complain about movies. And I'm paraphrasing that line. I mean, that movie was in some ways ahead of its time, because that's still what the internet is.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, complain about things they haven't seen, complain about things they don't know what they're going to be. You know, just, oh, well, that's a terrible idea. I saw somebody shared a video with me the other day about how people would react if the original Star Wars came out today. And it's just hilarious. Oh, yeah, just wave around a lightsaber. There's nothing dangerous about that. You know, oh, I'm really excited about seeing these two old guys go up against each other. You know, just his father. That's just ridiculous. You know, the whole, yeah, it's. I'm a little bit over internet outrage, which is funny because I think that's going to be the majority of the show today, is talking about things that the internet is outraged about. But we'll have some fun with it. We've got to take a break. We'll be back with more in just a moment. You're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Welcome back to Let's Go Pensacola. I am your host, Julio Diaz. We've got Jeremy Branch with us on the line from the Pop Culture Nihilist channel on YouTube. And that might sound a little bit different to you, but I'm here to tell you, if you didn't know, that actually is Linkin Park. That is the Linkin Park announced this week. If you guys are familiar with this band, this is one of the biggest bands of like the early 2000s. Was quite a big force in music for some time. Broke up about 7 years ago after the co-lead singer Chester Bennington tragically passed away. We thought that was it. You know, we thought that was the end of Linkin Park. But this week, Linkin Park announced coming back together with a new lead singer and, plot twist, female lead singer, Emily Armstrong, who's apparently a veteran of a couple other bands and has been a songwriter for some time, et cetera, et cetera. But she is the new co-lead singer, because Linkin Park's always had two singers, and Mike Shinoda is back and he's still doing his vocals on the songs. But we have a Linkin Park reunion announced and a tour coming, and I think new music coming. And they did a whole live show to announce this just the other day. So Jeremy, first of all, cash grab, or is this an actual hey, we've got something creative going on here?
That's definitely a question that I couldn't answer in good faith, but I do feel that Emily Armstrong is bringing something to the table that is interesting and in a really conventional sense. Chester Bennington's range and the way that it contrasts with Mike Shinoda's, I think kind of this stays true to that, while by doing something different, it definitely helps to separate it from Chester Bennington. And when I say that, if there was a guy that came into the group and he tried to do what Chester Bennington did, I think that a lot of fans would probably be more critical and be more likely to reject that, where this Emily is definitely not a replacement for Chester as far as a functional member of the band, but she is the new kind of, like you said, co-lead vocalist of it. So
and let's be clear, Mike Shinoda's vocals are more like rap vocals,
right?
So right.
I mean, takes a note and goes with it.
Yeah, Chester was kind of always the melodic voice of the band, and then Mike was the the more rhythmic voice of the band, if that makes sense.
As we talked about ad nauseum, they kind of came out of the new metal era, which was heavily influenced by rap and metal music. But I think Linkin Park kind of took it a step further and gave people something that was a little more accessible and a little more able to be listened to by audiences outside of that. And they continued to make music for years and years, like you said, up till 7 years ago. And just to clarify, and I'm curious about your take, if 10 is the biggest Linkin Park fan and 1 is somebody who thinks that Linkin Park stinks, I'm probably at an 8. I didn't follow their entire career, but I've loved all their singles. I love their first album, Hybrid Theory. So I'm a fan, but I can't speak to the band in a real deep connected way, you know? Mm-hmm.
And I'm probably at the other end of the spectrum. I don't hate them. I don't think they're garbage, but I'm not a real fan. I'd say maybe I'm somewhere between a 3 and a 4.
Sure.
So I will say, yeah, maybe some of this is my intrinsic bias. I do tend to like bands with female front persons, or I tend to like female acts, things like that. I think this is an improvement.
That is the hottest of takes.
Yeah, I mean, I know that, but I mean, you can get on me, but I like what I like, and I am more interested with Linkin Park with Emily Armstrong as the lead vocalist than I was with Chester Bennington. Straight out.
I respect it. You know, I love a good hot take. Yeah, I definitely am curious to know if they write new music.
Yeah, she sounds great. I haven't. They have released at least one new song that I'm aware of, so there is new music coming.
Cool.
So I'm interested to hear what that sounds like, and I also think it's really interesting that they went in this direction, because I can't think of too many bands. There's been a lot of bands over the years that have replaced their lead singers for whatever reasons. Your mind's immediately going to go to, and usually it's not because the lead singer passed away and, you know, they've decided to go on. A lot of times if a band loses their lead singer in that sense, they don't go on, or they might come back later, whatever, you know. I mean, oddly enough, Chester Bennington did replace the lead singer of another band who died at one point, because he took over for Scott Weiland in Stone Temple Pilots. Although I think he did that. I think he started doing that before Scott Weiland died, if I'm not mistaken. And then, Stone Temple Pilots have lost two singers at this point, and they are on the road with another singer now too. I think probably the most famous example of a band replacing its lead singer is going to be Van Halen.
You got Van Hagar, you got Van Halen.
Well, and you had the
other eras.
You had the brief and almost forgotten Van Sharon period too. Don't forget that. Yeah, that one album where they were done with Sammy Hagar and they brought in Gary Sharon from Extreme.
That happened.
That did happen. There's proof of it. I know everybody likes to forget it, but that did happen.
Did Peter Gabriel sing for Genesis?
Peter Gabriel was the original lead singer for Genesis, yes. And
had Peter Gabriel and Phil Collins.
Yeah, you had that one. I mean, there's been a number of them, and there's been a few, you know, things like after Michael Hutchence passed, NXS did a few gigs with Terrence Trent D'Arby singing lead vocals, and then
that's cool.
And then they did the whole reality show to find a new lead singer, and they did a couple of tours with that guy that his name was J.D. Fortune. That the guy that won the reality show to be the new lead singer of NXS.
There was another one of those reality shows, now that you bring it up, and unfortunately I'm not able to pull it right now.
There was one to replace Left Eye in TLC.
Interesting.
Yeah, which is another artist that left us before her time, actually. Mm-hmm. But that was always intended to be just for a couple of one-off gigs. Now, TLC has continued since then, but it's just T-Boz and Chili. And they just, I don't know what they do for the Left Eye parts in the songs. I don't know if they use a video screen or what they do, but TLC is still out there performing. But they're not performing with the person that won that contest. So, I can't think of too many cases, though, where a band has replaced their lead singer and they've gone with a gender change.
I can't pull any examples. How about you?
Well, I mean, I know that there was, it's one of those things that things come out over time. When David Lee Roth left Van Halen, one of the people that Eddie Van Halen approached was Patti Smyth. So we could have had a female fronted Van Halen. It didn't happen. She turned him down. She actually didn't really believe he was serious about it, which he apparently was. But yeah, we could have had Van Halen. It could have been, instead of Van Hagar, it could have been Van Smyth. That could happen. Apparently, he also went after Daryl Hall.
That's not what I would have expected.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think all of that's really interesting, and it's fun to play the what if game with that. But that's really kind of a divergent topic. I mean, there are definitely bands that have replaced male lead singers with female lead singers, but they've done it before they've gotten big. I mean, great example is No Doubt. No, Gwen Stefani was originally just like kind of a backing vocalist in No Doubt.
And the guitarist was the main vocalist?
Her brother, I believe, was the main vocalist. Her brother who ended up leaving the band because he became an animator on The Simpsons.
Interesting. And, I didn't realize any of that.
And that's why, if you go back, this is a fun little bit of trivia too. If you've ever seen one of my favorite episodes of The Simpsons, is the Homer Palooza episode of The Simpsons.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the one where Homer basically goes on Lollapalooza, and there's a bunch of band Cypress Hills in it, and Sonic Youth in it, and a bunch of other bands. But if you look in that episode closely, you can see that Gwen Stefani's brother Eric drew No Doubt into the episode, even though it was
cool.
Before No Doubt was nationally known. I mean, they'd had a couple of like minor records out, but they pre-Tragic Kingdom, let's put it that way, because that's the album where everybody came to know who No Doubt was. But yeah, and if you look carefully, All four members of No Doubt are in that episode. They don't have voice parts or anything, but they're on. If you know what you're looking for, you're going to recognize them when you see them. So yeah, I mean, I'm hard pressed to think of another one. There's been like, again, some one-off things. I know that when Nirvana was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, obviously Kurt was already gone, and they did some songs with Kim Gordon from Sonic Youth on vocals. They did some songs with Joan Jett on vocals. But that's very much a one-off thing. This is, as far as we can tell, intended to be a permanent ongoing replacement for Chester Bennington. Obviously, they're not bringing Chester back. That can't happen. But, you know, unless they're going to do like the hologram thing, which I think that moment kind of came and went.
Yeah, pretty fast too.
Yeah. I don't know, man. For me personally, this makes me more interested.
There is a new single that came available yesterday, so I will definitely be checking that out after we finish recording today.
Yeah, maybe we'll come back with that from the break, just to, if we can find it online, just to give a little sample of that too, and we can see what it sounds like. But, I don't know what the motivation here was. I don't know if this was the guys really wanted to play again and they, you know, had a creative impulse, or if they said, hey, we need some money. But, you know, it's interesting nevertheless. We got to take a break. Back with more in just a moment. You're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Welcome back to Let's Go Pensacola. I am your host, Julio Diaz. We've got Jeremy Branch with us on the line from the Pop Culture Knowledge Channel on YouTube. Sorry about that little skip there that we're Jeremy and I didn't hear, but you will hear when this goes out, because I didn't realize there was going to be a little naughty word in there. But that's a little bit of what the new Linkin Park sounds like. The Emptiness Machine is the first single from the upcoming new Linkin Park album with new vocalist Emily Armstrong joining the band. And it sounds kind of like Linkin Park, except with a female vocalist. What do you think, Jeremy?
Yeah, here's my music journalist attempt take. I think that I like Cut Time. I like the instrumentals of the song. I like Emily Armstrong's vocal approach, in particular, you know, kind of melding into to fit the band. The lyrics, you know, don't quite resonate in the same way that they did when I was a angsty young man. But at the same time, like you said, it sounds pretty true to Linkin Park style. Like, I think it could grow on me, but I don't love it immediately.
Now, I will say we came into that song about a minute into the song, because when we first put the song on to play at you, I literally like was looking for the skip ad button, because like between the way the video is set up and the official music video is on YouTube, so you can check that out for yourself. But the way the video is set up and the way the song sounded at the beginning, I thought I was like seeing an ad for a logistics company.
Yeah.
And like and literally we got like 20 seconds in and was like, I paused it. It's like, oh, I'm sorry, Jeremy, that's a commercial. I literally said that. And, you know, I got to wait to get past it. And it's like, wait a minute, there's no skip ad button here. And we fast forward a little bit. It's like, no, this is 3 minutes. This is the video. This is the song. Huh. And like, she doesn't come in until like the second verse. The whole first verse is Mike Shinoda. So I wanted to come in because the whole point is to talk about the new vocalist.
Yeah.
I wanted to come in with her vocal. Yeah, man. But I mean, like once she starts singing, I think it's pretty good. I like her voice.
Mm-hmm. I do too.
So, you know, I still maintain my slightly more interested than I was when Chester was alive stance here.
There was an artist, it might have been the guy from the Talking Heads, but there was somebody that said, like, he can't believe a perfect vocalist. And I thought that was insightful. And when you compare, I don't know, just for the layman, Bob Dylan to somebody like Ariana Grande, you feel like this authenticity or this realness in the voice of somebody like Dylan. And whether that's true or accurate, I think is debatable. But what I like about Emily Armstrong is there is a nice mix of both of those things in it. And I think that kind of speaks to what Chester Bennington did as well.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I would say that vocal talent is not necessarily the same thing as being a great singer. You can be a great singer and you can be a great, maybe I'm putting it the wrong way, but you can be a great vocalist without being a great singer.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Dylan's a great example of that, but there are lots of other great examples of that to where, you know, what they bring to music and to a song, it may not be technically the best singing that's ever been heard, but it is that kind of authenticity and that immediacy and just being the right voice for the material.
Yeah.
That you may not get in like, you know, somebody who's a more technically proficient singer and is always going to hit the exact right note and has perfect pitch. And, you know, there's a place for both. And I'm not saying that you can't have both. You can have both. But sometimes it's more interesting to hear the person that's the less technically proficient singer, but has the raw emotion and the feel and the, yeah, you know, there's any number of things you can think of that. You know, you're talking about angst, and it, you know, it always brings to mind, to me, the album that I think is completely timeless in its depiction of what it feels like to be an angsty teenager, maybe an angsty teenage boy in particular, but angsty teenager in general, I think.
Oh, hit me really, with this. This is interesting.
Is the debut Violent Femmes album.
Oh yeah.
It absolutely, like, it is just like this beautiful artistic crystallization of what it feels like to be like 14, 15 years old.
That's and a good pick. I like that.
In a way that I think has remained timeless and that future generations have continued to discover. And in fairness, I wasn't even the first generation that discovered this album. You know, I think the album came out in 83 originally, and I don't think I heard it for the first time until 86, 87, somewhere in there. But it really does. The only other piece of art that I can think of that has like kind of the same kind of timeless quality and continues to find new audiences over generations, even though some of it is dated, are John Hughes movies. Because John Hughes movies get that feeling of being 15, 16, 17 years old and everything in your world is so heightened and so dramatic and every little thing is life or death. And that, you know, that you relate to when you're that age. And
yeah,
you know, somebody had a discussion about that online this week and somebody was talking about how Some Kind of Wonderful is really melodramatic. It's like, yeah, that's the point.
Mm-hmm.
That's how it feels to be 16 years old.
Yeah, where like what you look back at as being trivial at the time just means it's your whole entire world.
Yeah, and that's how I feel about that first Violent Femmes album. And to bring that back around to what I was saying, Gordon Gano is not the greatest singer that ever walked the planet in terms of a technical standpoint. He has a very distinctive voice. He has a voice that you're absolutely going to remember and that you can immediately identify if you hear it. And you know, if you hear another Violent Femmes song that isn't one of the songs off that album, you're still going to immediately know it's the Violent Femmes. Or you know, he did put out a solo album or two, so it might be one of his solo tracks. But yeah, very much, you know, nobody else's voice would work for those songs the way that his voices work. And there've been covers of Violent Femmes songs. There's been some decent covers of Violent Femmes songs. I'm thinking in particular about Gnarls Barkley covering Gone Daddy Gone.
Oh yeah.
Which yeah, is a good cover. And you know, CeeLo Green, whatever else you might think of him as a person, he's a great singer, great voice, and has a different quality to his voice than Gordon Gano. And it worked, but it doesn't work like Gordon Gano's voice worked. It worked in a different way. And that there's something to be said for that too, when you can bring something new to a cover, you know, you're doing something interesting there too. But it all goes back to your point, Jeremy. Like, do I want to hear a bunch of other people covering the Violent Femmes and maybe not being able to bring that to it? Or do I want to hear the original? Even though, you know, Gordon Gano is probably, what, in his late 50s, early 60s now, I'd guess. And, and you know, probably doesn't feel the way that he felt when he recorded those songs. But he is still the voice. And I think it's the fact that he wrote those songs, too, has something to do with that as well. But born in 63, so he is 61. Yeah, I was right on it. You know, there's just a number of people you can say that same kind of thing about. You know, what Fred Schneider brings to the B-52s. There are people that find Fred Schneider's voice absolutely grating. And I have had people tell me I only like the B-52 songs that he's not on. But I mean, his persona, what he brings to the B-52s, I think is just so key to what the B-52s do. And while, you know, Kate and Cindy, of course, have those great female voices on those songs and can hit such amazing notes, and they have a lot of personality they bring too, it's not the same band without Fred.
Oh, no, absolutely.
And what he brings to that to that situation. So yeah, I mean, going back to what you were saying, Jeremy, I kind of think that, how does this fall in with Linkin Park? Like, do you feel like this is still Linkin Park with this different voice now?
Yeah, it's when you and I listened to a little bit of the live performance, it felt like Linkin Park. This new song, and there are so many variables. Is it just the new direction in their writing process, the evolution of an artist? Is it other reasons? I feel like this new song isn't capturing Linkin Park in the same way, but I would almost point more to Mike Shinoda than I would to Emily at this point. And yeah, it was David Byrne that said, the better an artist's voice is, the harder it is to believe them. I just wanted to confirm that real quick. But yeah, time will tell. I'm really interested to hear the album, but I know that there are some people that are just going to outright be like, that's not Chester, that's not my Linkin Park. And I think that's fair as well.
Well, we've got to take a break. We'll be back with more in just a moment. You're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620.
Never been, but all the things that you've seen.
Radio 92.3 and AM 1620. Welcome back to Let's Go Pensacola. I am your host, Julio Diaz. We've got Jeremy Branch with us on the line from the Pop Culture Nihilist channel on YouTube. And we're going to not spend the rest of the show talking about music, but I do have to very quickly mention that I didn't pick this song specifically because Oasis announced that they're reuniting this week. But I think we have to mention that Oasis is reuniting, don't we?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing that's happening. Are you excited about that, Jeremy?
Yeah, absolutely. I thought we talked about this a little bit, but I am definitely interested to see what they do. I've been a fan of them. I'm not like a diehard fan, but I like all of the music to some varying degrees. Maybe we didn't talk about it on air, but yeah, I definitely a fan.
That particular song's kind of warmed over Beatles, isn't it?
I mean, aren't Oasis kind of warmed over Beatles?
I guess that's fair, but yeah, apparently people losing their minds over this in the UK, but I think we did maybe talk about this a little bit, but anyway, more to the point, the reason I played this song is because we have a number of creative people this week who are looking back in anger at the adaptations of their work for television, for lack of a better term. And I think we want to start here, and we may get to more of it or not, but Jeremy's got a lot to say about one in particular, and that is George R.R. Martin, who released and then deleted a statement this week expressing anger at how season 2 of House of the Dragon went on Max and HBO. He was in particular unhappy about the choice to exclude a character that was a character that was included in the books, although I think there was more to it than that. So hit me with your take here, Jeremy.
So not to fear, we're not going to work ahead of anything that's happened up to this point in the series. If you've been following along the show, you know we talked about season 2 in great detail. This is my Drake versus Kendrick, ladies and gentlemen. This is the beef that I'm the most invested in, and it's really not so much the beef between George and HBO, which I think has been conflated, but again, it's the beef of the fans with this show and this property that we all supposedly love. It's wild, right? So yeah, George R.R. Martin released a statement on his Not a Blog a couple of days ago, and I don't think it was scathing. I really don't think it was scathing. He said that he enjoyed the majority of the first 2 episodes and thought that they were very well written and produced and acted and all of that stuff. But he did have some critiques, and lo and behold, he thinks his version of the story is better than the one that was rewritten. Yeah, that to me is like a non-starter. And you and I talked about it a little bit in text, and I totally agree with that sentiment. Like, what's unusual about the person who created the thing thinking their version of the thing is better than the people that adapted the thing? But what it has done is, I think it has further galvanized a lot of the divisive rhetoric around season 2, which I'm on record saying I thought it was very, very good. I do think that there were some pacing issues, and I do think that the structure of it felt a little bit clumsy, because you write a story, or writers create stories the same way that they create scenes, and that's the same way that they create seasons of television in a traditional 3-act structure. And I feel that what season 2 did is essentially end after the second act. And I can see how that would be frustrating to people, but I don't like this idea of like, it wasn't a fulfilling conclusion to the story, so therefore it was all bad. And I kind of just wanted to, first of all, ask you what you thought about George's post, and then maybe even why you think, and this is just conjecture, why you think that he was quick to delete it.
I think because he was quick to delete it because HBO has made him a whole lot of money, and it looks to continue to make him a whole lot of money. And they were not happy that the creator was out there adding fuel to the fire against the show.
You think it was a phone call?
I absolutely think it was a phone call. It's like, hey, George, can you do us a favor and take that down?
Yeah, I wondered that. Like, was it a phone call? Was it an email? Or was it just that he saw the way that people were construing his words and was like, oh, this isn't what I intended. They only saw the bad and they didn't see any of the good things that I say. And now they are kind of turning it into the most extreme case of this argument.
I mean, all of that's possible. But I think in the end, the bottom line is George realized you don't bite the hand that's feeding you.
Absolutely. It is so crazy because he, and not only bite the hand that feeds, that's the perfect way of saying it, but he's got more shows in development. He stands to gain on the success of these series, and by going and turning the fan base against the projects that are, you know, coming down the road, I think it's crazy. And Ryan Condal has been in attack mode, and I think understandably so from a psychological perspective. He has to make tough decisions. And for showrunners, there's obviously what you want to happen and then the reality of budgets and time constraints and cast members and having children working on sets for long hours, like so many logistical things that like compromises have to be made, and he could be managing this to the best of his ability and still fall short just out of like practicality. So I think that the audience has like had so much vitriol towards Ryan Condal is kind of unfair to him.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is all kind of overblown and it's going to blow over, and people are not going to stop watching this show. We know we've got two more seasons of this show. It's going to continue to be a big hit. They may complain about it, but they're still going to be watching it. And there nobody's going to not watch the Hedge Night or whatever it's called that is going to be coming next year either. Yeah. But I think if you have the creator of that world continuing to be out there in the media doing what looks like dumping on it, whether it is or not, that's going to have a long-term effect.
Yeah. And yeah, probably worse than any other single voice.
Yeah. Especially when you have the situation where he is still sitting on uncompleted books. And you have the situation where we've seen what happened when they went on without his guidance in the final seasons of Game of Thrones. Although he himself has defended that. I think it wasn't the smartest move for George to put that out there. And I think that that's why he deleted it. Whether there was pressure from HBO or not, I think he said, hey, wait a minute here. I stand to lose a whole lot if they stop making these.
Absolutely. And then, again, in the world of conjecture, do you think that the show suffered due to the loss of Miguel Sapochnik, who was co-showrunner in season one? Did you feel that there was a substantial decline in quality of writing, structure of the story? Do you think that that has contributed to maybe the more lukewarm reception of season two?
Not that I noticed, but I could see where some other people might say that. I know there was a lot of qualms about the way that the story was presented in the, especially the final few episodes of the season, in terms of how they chose to break up storylines.
Mm-hmm.
And we've talked about that on the show in the past, about that maybe, you know, it would have been better served to have an entire episode about Daemon's hauntings at Harrenhal, or an entire episode about, you know, these various like subplots that were going on. But no, I mean, I'm still as excited about the show as I've ever been.
Yeah, I tend to feel the same way. And I don't fall into the camp that thinks that season two was any sort of like significant drop off. I don't think there's such a thing as a perfect adaptation or a perfect series. But I think as far as just strictly measuring it on the metric of everything else that's on TV, this is top tier television. So I don't know why people are so up in arms about it.
Well, very quickly before we have to go, I wanted to mention also that we also have more shots fired in the ongoing war between Marvel and Disney and X-Men 97 showrunner Bo DeMeo.
Yeah.
They came out and said that they let him go because of a misconduct probe and the egregious nature of the findings. Well, he's shooting back this week that he has the receipts about the toxic working environment and near criminal working conditions, and that he never did anything that was egregious misconduct, and is planning to tell the whole world about it in a video on OnlyFans.
Because if you want to get the news out to the masses, you do it on your OnlyFans behind a paywall.
Yeah, I mean, which isn't going to matter because every entertainment site in the world is going to subscribe to his OnlyFans and then write a story about it 5 minutes later. So it will still get out there. But
yeah, that's the reason I'm subscribed to his OnlyFans, I promise.
There's a lot of he said, she said going on here, but I am interested to see how this plays out. And I'm sure we'll talk about it more when more comes out. But we got to wrap up for this week, man. Always interesting, and we'll have a lot more to talk to you about next week for sure. Until then, you're listening to Let's Go Pensacola on News Radio 92.3 and AM 1620.